Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the Trump administration has announced rules further controlling the reproductive health care that women reliant on federally funded family planning programs can receive. Corporate media are reporting it as a story about abortion, but proponents of such measures would tell you their designs are much, much bigger. We'll talk about this latest attack on women's rights and its context with Kinsey Hastett, senior policy manager at the Guttmacher Institute. Also on the show, there's nothing new about corporate media owners sacrificing the quality of journalism for profit, but it still feels like turning a new corner when a hometown paper like the Denver Post is taken over by a hedge fund that calls itself a specialist in making money off distress. We'll hear about the protests at the Denver Post and other papers owned by Alden Global Capital from Corey Hutchins, journalist for the Colorado Independent and Columbia Journalism Review. That's coming up, but first we'll take a quick look back at some recent press. Facebook announced it's partnering with DC think tank the Atlantic Council to monitor for misinformation and foreign interference. The details of the plan are vague, but the council has stated the goal is to design tools to bring us closer together instead of driving us further apart, whatever that means. Behind its bland name, the Atlantic Council is associated with very particular interests. It's funded by the U.S. State Department, Navy, Army, and Air Force, along with NATO, various foreign powers, and major Western corporations, including weapons contractors and oil companies. FAIR's Adam Johnson notes that what diversity of opinion exists is largely about how much and where U.S. military and soft power influence should be wielded, not if they should. But with the exception of Splinter, news outlets showed no curiosity at all about a government-backed entity telling us which news is fake or how it works when a venture supposedly meant to curb foreign interference is bankrolled by the United Arab Emirates, Japan, and Taiwan, to name a few. Not that U.S. government money is exempt from the foreign qualifier with its suggestion of malicious influence. To most of Facebook's 2.2 billion users, after all, the United States is a foreign country. The far left is winning the Democratic Civil War, was the headline over a Washington Post report on the results of recent primary elections. So what counts as far left to the Post, the newspaper owned by the world's richest human? Here are the positions cited by the Post's James Homan to characterize the unelectable activists who are thwarting Democratic hopes to take back the House, or who are otherwise part of a leftward lurch. Kara Eastman of Nebraska advocated for universal background checks to buy guns, raising taxes, and decriminalizing marijuana. John Fetterman in Pennsylvania campaigned on universal health care and legalizing marijuana. Running for governor in Idaho, Paulette Jordan based her platform on protecting more public lands, as well as promising to expand Medicaid, relax marijuana laws, reduce incarceration, and limit corporate tax loopholes. Some candidates were implicitly placed on the far left by the fact that they successfully challenged Democratic moderates, thus causing what the Post called a new bout of heartburn among party strategists. For example, Pennsylvania congressional candidate Susan Wild was worrisome because she defeated John Morganelli, who, the Post notes, opposes abortion rights and sanctuary cities, and whom Wild criticized for speaking positively about Trump and tweeting that he was open to taking a job in the administration. You know, like moderates do. As for those far-left issues, the latest polling from CBS News found 56% in favor of raising taxes on large corporations, 58% wanting higher taxes for wealthy Americans. As for marijuana, Broad majorities are in favor of legalizing it. Gallup found 64%, and 53% told Kaiser they favored a national health plan. A recent Marist poll actually asked people if they would vote for or against a congressional candidate who wanted to require universal background checks for gun purchases. 86% said they would vote definitely for a candidate who took what the Washington Post calls a far-left position. One starts to get the suspicion that these candidates are not really far-left at all, and that Jeff Bezos' post would just very much like to scare you away from voting for them. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. People like to say the devil is in the details. For its account of the Trump administration's proposed changes to rules around family planning programs, the New York Times headline, "Trump rule would bar some abortion advice at federally funded clinics," suggests details might be where it's at. It's just some advice at some clinics. Even more so, the headline chosen by the Washington Post, "Is it a gag rule after all? A closer look at changes to Title X funding regarding abortion." But what if the devil, as it were, is in the big picture? If the measures chipping away at women's reproductive rights, waiting periods, notification requirements, clinic closings, were all of a piece, and this new rule requiring a bright line of physical and financial separation between Title X family planning programs and those in which abortion is supported or referred, is simply another tool in an agenda that is most usefully addressed by media at its root. Coverage focused too hard on branch. The Post gives credulous attention to supposed distinctions between abortion counseling and referral, leaves untested certain unspoken premises. That abortion is not health care, and so it's reasonable to segregate it. That women's bodies, and especially poor women's bodies, are ultimately socially owned, and so it's reasonable for others to debate and decide what happens to them. And that even though nearly one in four women in the U.S. will have an abortion, it's okay to leave the subject shrouded in stigma, suffering, and misinformation. The changes around federal family planning funding offer as good a chance as any to recenter the conversation around reproductive rights. We're joined now by Kinsey Hastett, a senior policy manager in the Guttmacher Institute's Washington, D.C. office. She joins us by phone from D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Kinsey Hastett.
Hi there, Janine. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, by saying media should address the various predations on reproductive rights as being related, I don't mean to say, of course, that we shouldn't get right the precise implications and impacts of each of those predations. I know that the language on this latest proposed rule has just come out, but from what you have seen, what do you think it would mean on the ground?
I think there's absolutely no question that the proposal we've seen from the Trump administration is very much a revival of the domestic gag rule as first proposed by President Reagan. It would indeed exclude safety net health centers that also offer abortion using non-federal funds, and would do so by requiring extensive physical and financial separation. And for the record, as you have noted, abortion is very much legal. And it is also perfectly legal for clinics to offer that service using separate funds in the same space that they offer Title X supported family planning care. It also would ban referral for abortion and actually call on providers to actively mislead their patients who have expressed a desire to seek abortion services by giving them lists of providers who offer different comprehensive care and not denoting which ones are actually offering abortion services. It also requires that pregnant patients be referred for prenatal services and other care related to delivery, regardless of their wishes. And it also undermines the provision of comprehensive and unbiased information on all of a patient's pregnancy options, removing the guarantee that all patients seen through this program currently have that they would be able to receive such non-directive counseling. I think additionally, the rule that we have seen so far goes further, too. It's really making clear that at the heart of this effort from the Trump administration is an intent to totally reshape the network of entities and the scope of services that have long been supported by this Title X publicly funded family planning program. They are seeking to disadvantage providers who focus on reproductive health, which includes but is not limited to Planned Parenthood, and in fact are opening the door to Title X funds to ideologically motivated entities that are actually unwilling or unable to provide a broad range of contraceptive method options. These rules also promote other ideologically motivated approaches to family planning, such as abstinence until marriage, and take away the guarantee of contraceptive access for many patients, I think, by redefining family planning. And I appreciate the, you know, wanting to understand both this rule, but connect it to a much broader, at this point, relentless and coercive assault that we are seeing from the Trump administration against individuals' sexual and reproductive health and rights. Because at the end of the day, we are talking about denying patients the highest standard of family planning care. And we are talking about denying women access to information and services that are necessary in their own right to self-determination.
Let me just draw out as a point of information, Title X, the 1970 statute that created these federally funded family planning programs, already doesn't cover abortion services. The law already prohibits federal funds from covering abortion. Let's just say that, right?
Yes, for sure. Since the program's inception in 1970, Title X funds have always been prohibited from going toward abortion services. And currently, entities that receive Title X funds must already demonstrate that they are keeping those funds and the family planning services they support quite separate from any abortion services they may provide.
That's why I think media coverage that just narrowly dives into this latest thing that was said and doesn't give you that context is so deeply misleading. And also, I think that the Trump White House gains a lot of leverage, and I, you know, charge media with this as well, from sort of threatening something and then doing something that looks like a little bit different, and there's kind of a sigh of relief, it was going to be this, and then it turned out to be something less. Of course, we want details, but in some ways, that focus on details loses what's really happening.
Absolutely. I think it's essential to step back and see the forest for the trees. In all manner of regard, we have seen the Trump administration and social conservatives in Congress really advancing a coercive agenda against individuals' reproductive health and rights. Everything from seeking to roll back affordable health insurance coverage, both in the private and the public markets, undermining people's access to affordable contraceptive coverage under the ACA, trying to undercut comprehensive sex education programs, and now this most recent attack on publicly funded family planning. I think there are any number of fronts on which we're seeing this attack, and it's unconscionable and it's relentless.
Yeah, and in the same way that isolating rhetorically abortion in the way that the folks who are opposing it are not isolating it, it really is a part of a bigger agenda for them. I also find it odd that media tend to report abortion and reproductive health as though it only had meaning for pregnant women, you know, when, of course, policies determining whether a person has the right to decide when and if she gives birth, that's about all women, you know. It's a much broader issue, and the tendency to sort of make it very specific. And even in this case, you could read this current media coverage and think, oh, well, I'm not going to be going to a Title X clinic, you know, so this news doesn't impact me. That's a concern.
Absolutely. Well, and I think, you know, it has been additionally notable that much of the media coverage has focused on the abortion aspect of this, which is a frame being advanced by anti-abortion advocates and policymakers, when in reality, this particular vein of attack is very much focused on contraceptive care, is focused on people's access to whatever methods of birth control are going to work best for them. And so even in trying to go after abortion and framing it as such, I think in a lot of places, the fact that this is really an effort to undermine people's access to birth control and related preventive services is getting a bit lost.
Well, Media Matters' Sharon Cann found that Fox News was responsible for 54% of all the segments about abortion on evening cable news. There seems to be in media, and there's an anti-abortion space, but there's no pro-abortion space, you know? So I feel like right-wingers get to say that abortion should be a source of pain and stigma and silence and suffering. And then liberals get to say, but legal. And FAIR Research has found that as the restrictions on reproductive rights go up, the sheer amount of coverage tends to go down. And in that silence, misinformation can grow like mildew, you know, including just simple medical, biological misinformation. I just wonder, what are some to you of the most misunderstood aspects of your work area of publicly funded family planning programs? What frustrates you when you come up against the way people misunderstand things?
You know, I think one of the pieces, again, that often gets lost in the narrative are the people who rely on publicly funded family planning for care. Because at the end of the day, I can sit in DC and dissect words and we can pontificate, but where the rubber meets the road is for people who rely on these publicly funded programs and providers and have found providers that they trust. The whole point of Title X in the beginning was to kind of close the resource gap between women and couples who have more resources and those who have less and face systemic barriers to accessing affordable and high quality care. Because everyone has the right to determine for themselves whether and when to have children, whether and when to become pregnant, and to maintain a healthy, you know, sex life. And I think when we are talking about all of these various and sundry attacks, and as policymakers exercise them on publicly funded programs, which is, of course, where they have the most authority, ultimately we are jeopardizing the health and well-being of millions of people who are largely low income, largely people of color, and people who are otherwise underserved and have faced so many barriers to getting care, and some even who have experienced historic coercion when it comes to reproductive health. And so when we are talking about imposing subpar standards of care or forcing providers to mislead their patients in this context, it's incredibly troubling and, in fact, I would say offensive.
Well, I understand some 20 state attorneys general support a nationwide preliminary injunction to stop Trump from reducing access to Title X. In practical terms, what do you think may happen next? What does the resistance or pushback look like?
I think only time will tell. We have to see over the next couple of months how all of this rolls out. The Trump administration first advanced new criteria to assess applications for these Title X grants earlier this year, which, as you point out, prompted lawsuits from a couple of organizations. And so what happens to those lawsuits will matter. You know, which type of entities apply for Title X funding will matter. Those applications actually happen to be due today. So we'll see how this network starts to shape up over the course of the next few months or how it might change. And then I think when we see these proposed regulations actually published in the Federal Register, if they look like this draft does, there will be mass outcry from professional medical associations, public health experts, providers, advocates, and people themselves.
We've been speaking with Kinsey Hastett, Senior Policy Manager at the Guttmacher Institute. You can find their work online at guttmacher.org. Thank you so much, Kinsey Hastett, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
Since hedge fund Alden Global Capital has taken control of the Denver Post, the paper has seen rounds of layoffs. The newsroom has gone from 200 or so people to more like 70, with 30 more jobs slated to be cut this summer. Journalists have been moved to the printing plant to further cut costs for Alden, whose founder, Randall Smith, describes himself as investing in distress. Denver Post workers protesting the unceremonious gutting of their newspaper were joined recently by journalists from some of the other 90-odd papers Alden controls via ownership of Digital First Media at a rally at the Vulture Fund's HQ in New York City. In a New York Times account, the Denver Post's Elizabeth Hernandez says, as reporters do, that she doesn't like being the story. But she adds, quote, "If we don't tell our own story now, I don't know how long we'll be able to tell our communities," close quote. Corey Hutchins is a journalist for the Colorado Independent, as well as a correspondent for Columbia Journalism Review's United States Project. He joins us now by phone from Denver. Welcome to Counterspin, Corey Hutchins.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, the story of the Denver Post has not been front page news, if I can say it that way, around the country. A few national pieces have appeared, like that one in the New York Times. But I wonder if people maybe see it as a local story, which it is and it isn't, right? How would you put what's happening at the Post in context for people outside Colorado?
I think right now what's happening in Denver, what's happening to the Denver Post and a lot of its sister papers throughout Colorado, which there are about a dozen smaller daily and smaller weekly papers also owned by Digital First Media in Colorado. What's happening, though, in Denver, I think, is becoming a national story. Now, I write about the media for CJR and for the Colorado Independent. So, you know, I'm seeking out these stories, and I write a weekly newsletter about the media in Colorado. And the past 3 weeks, it's been a lot more work because I'm actually reading tons of stories in larger magazines on both coasts and in other states about what's going on at the Denver Post. I'm sure a lot of the media about this is being consumed by people who pay very close attention to media and media criticism, but I do think that there's going to be some spillover into the mainstream population and mainstream news consumers. One of the things that's pushing that is the public activism that the journalists and their allies, you know, are creating, protesting outside of their newsrooms. They're getting the TV coverage locally and nationally on that. Here in Denver, the community is aware of what's going on. How broad that becomes across the country is a big question.
Well, you interviewed Julie Reynolds, the independent reporter who's really tracked the story of Alden Global Capital and its CEO, Randall Smith, and traced where it's taking money from and where that money's going. And I was struck by her description of what it was like working for a DFM paper, the Monterey Herald. And I'm not saying it's unique to DFM, but she talked about not being able to get a manila folder, you know, and reporters buying their own pens, you know. But then I was struck particularly by, she mentioned demands that reporters all of a sudden need to get out 3 stories a day with their name on them, quote, even if you rewrote a press release, close quote. So there's a direct line. We're talking about how to keep the public interested. There's a direct line between cost cutting in the newsroom and, you know, crap in the newspaper, isn't there? That's a relationship.
Beyond just the pressure on reporters to have to do more, and out of the Denver Post, you know, I wrote a story for CJR about how at one point there were basically byline quotas. It's this whole thing about, you know, we've got to do more with less. I will say the Denver Post still does really quality journalism, and they should be really proud about that.
Industry watcher Jack Schaefer says it's kind of silly to be mad at Alden. They're a money-making company making money. And anyway, it's readers who are responsible for the death of newspapers because they don't buy them anymore. In his words, Smith may be a rapacious fellow, but his primary crime is recognizing that print is approaching its expiration date and is acting on the fact that more value can be extracted by sucking the marrow than by investing more deeply or selling. Is that cynical? Is that true? Is that both? What do you make of that attitude as we go forward?
That argument is kind of the one that's also being pushed by corporate people at Digital First Media and the editor of the Denver Post, who basically says, hey, it's not so much that a hedge fund owns the newspaper. The reason we're downsizing and laying off reporters is really only because of market forces. It's because our subscription rates are shrinking and so is our advertising revenue. Now, that is true. Their subscription rates probably are shrinking and their advertising revenue is declining. Now, the other side of that is folks who say, well, that's happening at other newspapers too, but those papers are also willing to accept a lower profit margin than the newspapers owned by Digital First Media, who, according to national newspaper analyst Ken Doctor, have really high double-digit profits that he says are better than their peers. You do have this nationwide problem of print declining because of ad revenues and less people subscribing. And I think it's exasperated at the papers owned by Digital First Media because their hedge fund wants these massive profits. Kind of creates a perfect storm if you're, you know, working for a paper like that.
Absolutely. People say it's okay that newspapers are dying because the internet. And I just wonder, what do you think would be lost if, for example, the Denver Post were to be starved into non-existence eventually? What gets lost when we lose papers?
Bottom line, information. If the Denver Post goes away, it'll be the first major city of its size without a local newspaper. I think that would be disastrous. There was a lawmaker who was quoted by a public radio station, a reporter who was kind of going around and asking for reactions at the legislature. What do you think about all this stuff at the Denver Post? And she overheard some lawmaker joke, well, I guess it means we'll be able to do whatever we want now. That may have been a joke, but I think that's a pretty sad commentary and kind of crystallizes the worst of the worst that would happen, right? You've got less people doing journalism in a city like this, then the truth is we don't know what we don't know, and that thought's pretty scary.
We've been speaking with Corey Hutchins, reporter for the Colorado Independent and Columbia Journalism Review. Thank you so much, Corey Hutchins, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you. Anytime.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and transcripts on FAIR's website, fair.org. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.